Good morning. It's going to be a little different this morning. I took notes. And I'm the world's worst with notes, so you may have to bear with me. But it's a subject that's been on my mind for some time. And I hear questions about it in discussions and studies outside the church and in the church. And I have just been impressed to talk about it this morning, so I'm going to. The power of God. We all know that phrase. We use it all the time. I think a lot of times we don't appreciate it. And there's all kinds of subject matter that you can go to with talking about the power of God. Actually, libraries are full of subjects about the power of God, even they don't acknowledge it. But I'm going to pick one that at least I'm familiar with. I think you are. It's called a Bible, King James Version of the Bible. And the power of God that caused it to be here this morning, maybe in your laps. And what the process went through to have it in your laps this morning. Moses is generally credited with composing the first five books of the Old Testament through the power of God. First off, he wasn't born when all of that started, so he had to get it from somewhere. As far as the historians know, the first written thing about the Bible was the Ten Commandments. That was about 1400 BC. And Moses went up on a mountain to get him. We know that story from the children of Israel built an idol while he was gone. So obviously he was gone for a while because it takes a little while to come up with the idea, convince people to, and then melt down gold and make a statue. So it just wasn't an afternoon project. But when he came back, of course, we know the story. They had changed their minds about God, and he got mad and broke them, and he had to go get them again. But they were written in stone. Well, the process went on from there. We understand that scribes wrote the scriptures back in the early days, in the BC days, I'm going to say. But they didn't invent writing, and they didn't invent what to write on. Parchment is what they used. Parchment is what Moses used to write the Bible on. Parchment is animal skin, processed animal skin. Try to take a piece of leather and write legibly on it. You can't. It's too porous. It isn't of the consistency. Well, before they could do that, they had to be put in a position to do that, the children of Israel. And that started with Joseph. Being held in jealousy by his brothers, they threw him in a pit and sold him, and he went to Egypt, and he paved the way for the children of Israel to come to Egypt because of a famine. And the centuries that they were down there, they learned a lot, including how to make parchment, because that was an Egyptian skill. And the parchment they learned about was you split a cow skin or a cow hide. Now, I don't know how you do that. I worked a lot of leather when I was younger. And I don't know how you split something that thick. but they do it. And then you soak it in a bunch of different ingredients, make it pliable, and when you do it right, then you can take iron oxide and put it on a pen, moisten it and put it on a pen, and when you touch it to this leather that has been soaked in these ingredients, and I can't tell you right now what those ingredients are, I forgot, it turns black. And it's distinctive. And it doesn't bleed or run. That's how they learn to write. You want a Torah written today, and you want an actual Torah written today, there are factories in Israel that make this parchment. And that's the only thing that the Hebrews will use, or the Jews will use, or the Hebrews, I'm going to say. That's the only thing they will use to write spiritual messages on, or Torahs. And it dries, and you can fold it, and you can crease it, and you can do all kinds of things with it. And the letters stay there, and it doesn't crack or peel, or you can roll it into scrolls. And that's how they started recording this first history, and that's how Moses did it. For all the times that he went, all the times that he did all his writing while they were out in the desert wandering, it was 40 years. That's how he recorded those things. So here you got several million people out wandering in the desert, and he's got to have a lot of parchment. So they learned how to make it. So that was one of the industries while they were out there. And God caused that. God knew who made parchment. All of those things were created by God. We just had to discover to use them and how to use them and how to use them correctly. Trial and error, probably, undoubtedly. But the end result was that we have a record of the first five books of the Old Testament made by Moses back then. And all this parchment was actually individual sheets or scrolls. The Bible as we know it didn't exist until 1200 AD. A book. Thing with pages that we could turn. You had piles of scrolls before, you had piles of parchment before, you had piles of scrolls, and that's the way they were read. It was 500 BC before the Old Testament was completed. It wasn't a quick process. It didn't run out here to a publisher. They had to do things the way they understood and the way they did things back then with the technology they had. And by the first century, the 27 books of what, or the manuscripts, the Greek manuscripts of what we call the New Testament had been compiled. So it was hundreds and hundreds of years that all this information that's in that Bible of yours was amassed, preserved, kept, saved, however you want to say it. For hundreds of years, all these individual documents. Wonder how that could happen. Power of God. And that's the only way you can say it. It's not on man, not over centuries and centuries. It's the power of God. It's his influence. By 382 AD, the Latin Vulgate, which consisted of the 39 Old Testament books, the 14 Apocrypha books, and the 27 New Testament books had been compiled. So these things weren't all in one spot until then. This was the basis for the Roman Catholic religion. They call it the Codex. It's what it's referred to now. I was at a funeral of a relative here in another state a couple of years ago. They didn't refer to it as the Bible or the Codex. Apparently it was a pretty forward-thinking liberal denomination. They call it the ancient text. That's all they call it. So this is still in a state of flux is what you call it, I guess. I think I'll stay with the Bible for my title. But by 500 AD, the scriptures had been translated into over 500 languages. Now remember, no pages yet, no book yet, and everything had to be written on parchment that had to be prepared. You soak the parchment in these ingredients, and they were just regular natural ingredients, and then you put holes in it and stretch it on a frame and let it dry. And it was half the thickness of leather, and it was paper-like. But when it was all said and done, it was pliable. So they had to do this for thousands of years to record our history. And then they had to write it out by hand. No typing, no word processing, by hand. That's what scribes did. And that's all they did all their lives. It was a respected profession, scribes were. They were people of the community, people of prominence. King Constantine, back in Istanbul times, I guess you'd say, wanted to join a religion. And he checked around and found out that the religion that he thought allowed him the most leeway in continuing to do what he wanted to do was Christianity. So what he did, he took the Christians out of the Colosseums where they were being fed to the lions, and he put them in the royal court. Now, when you do that, you exert a little bit of influence, just a little bit. So that's where Christianity became tainted, because of the people that were all of a sudden enjoying being on top of the pile instead of being on the bottom of the pile, could call the shots and they could do things, and they also had to justify to King Constantine, who had decided that he was going to find the remains of all the original 12 apostles and put them in one building. And he became so wrapped up in this that he put a space right in the middle, a grave right in the middle, and that was going to be his grave. And he gave the edict that they were to recover all the remains of all the apostles, put them in one building, and that was our first cathedral, or church. Churches before that were groups of people in the house. I go to a lot of churches when I travel. I go to churches here, groups of people in a house. It's the people that's the church. And that concept is nothing new. But Christianity became grand and glorious after that because it was of royalty. God knew that. But that was their choice. He was preserving the information. It's man's choice of what he does with it. And that's still true today. That brought the Roman Catholic Church into existence. They still remain in power in their world, I guess you'd say. And at one time, it was a global power. So in 1800 AD, the Holy Roman Emperor Charlemagne ordered the standardization of the Vulgate, which was this pile of stuff, this pile of information, and it became the Alcuin Bible. It's what they called it. And it was in Latin. Wasn't in Greek, wasn't in Hebrew, wasn't in Aramaic, wasn't in Chaldean, it was in Latin. 400 years later, the Franciscan and Dominican friars were copying complete Bibles in Latin in a size that you could put in your pocket. And that was the first book. So this wasn't a book. This was a pile of manuscripts up until 1200 A.D. They were also the first to standardize the order of how the books in the Bible appeared. There was no order before. You did it the way you did it. The people in Egypt did it the way they did it. The people in Syria did it the way they did it. And there was no rhyme or reason to it. They also divided the books into chapters, because before that it was strictly narrative. And if you really look at your scriptures, you'll see that the subject matter goes right down through the chapters and narratives. The stories told, they made a stab at trying to make it look make sense, but there's times when the subject matter goes right on down into the next chapter. But they did it. And it was accepted because now you could go to chapter 6. Which, by the way, was also the way the Palmyra version of the Book of Mormon was written first. I've got one. It's only got chapters. There's no verses. Verses didn't appear until 1553, when a bunch of French Protestants in Switzerland decided to verse it. So now they didn't have to go down to chapter 6 and paragraph 18 or whatever it was, however it was that they located it. You could go to chapter 6, verse 3. And that's what we do today, and we take it for granted, and we're used to it, and we didn't think it was anything different. But it is. And that was a big difference. Because you could get everybody, quote, on the same page. And also by the 1200s, there was enough non-Bible scholars that there was being serious questions raised about this accuracy of this Vulgate, or Alcuin Bible. Because in it was precepts. You could pay the church to forgive you of a sin. Call it an indulgence. For example, you committed a theft. You could go to the priest for $5. He'd forgive you. Commit a burglary. $100. He would forgive you. Commit a murder. $1,000. He would forgive you. And a lot of the histories back then that were written by those in power within the Catholic Church, they were proud of the fact that they had saved more people than the 12 apostles all put together. They really believed it. But that was indulgences, is what they called that. And that was in the Bible back then, or what they called the Bible. You could also pay, if my dad passed away, they were taught, they would go to purgatory. And for amount of money, the priest would pray my dad out of purgatory. They still do that. But it costs you back then. So all of these things were a great source of revenue to the church. Plus, they had a lot of power and authority because of this. So when all of these people started researching the Bible and researching what was in it and comparing it to the original manuscripts, they started thinking, wait a minute. That isn't what's in there. Those things aren't in here. That's not what that says. The Catholic Church quickly realized that if they'd allowed this to happen, the authority of the church and their income would disappear. So they put a stop to it. If you read a Bible, or if you had a Bible in anything other than Latin, and you read it yourself, you could be burned at the stake. And we think we're persecuted. But that was common practice, to burn them at the stake for having something that they could understand and read for themselves. And this was the information that came from the manuscripts and the things written clear back in the BC era, I'm going to say. God preserved it, but men still had their choice. But he preserved it, because they still had the manuscripts. It was 1408 when the Catholic Church forbade any English translations of the Bible, but they were too late. And this shows you how they thought back then. There was a guy named John Wycliffe, and he produced the first handwritten English Bible, and it was from the manuscripts, and it was about 1380s. And the only thing he had for information was the Catholic Bible, the Vulgate. So that's what he used, but he put it in English. Now anybody that could read it. In direct contradiction to the order from the church. But it was a huge hit because, for once, you could read it. Now I've run into that. I've run into that in my travels. We had a lady named Evelyn York. She was in a rest home in Kalispell, Montana. This was one of the most spiritual ladies I've ever met. She'd had MS for 41 years. She couldn't move. Somebody had to move her leg if she wanted her leg moved. She couldn't move. And that was about the sweetest, most blessed person you could ever meet. First time Joel Yates and I went there to meet her, we went in, we had a sacrament, we had a prayer. We come out of there after talking to her and listening to her, and Joel says, He says, we went in there to give her a blessing, and we've come out of there with a blessing. And he was right, because she was special. And she was known that way by the people in the nursing home, her caregivers. And by the time we had met her, she had acquired a reputation there that if they had a question about religion, the caregivers came and asked her. And apparently she was right all the time, because they all kept coming and asking her, and she ended up being the problem solver for religion there. Well, she had one lady that come in one day, says, Evelyn, it was a nurse, do you think I could buy a Bible? And Evelyn says, well, of course you can buy a Bible. She says, well, she says, my church says you're not supposed to have a Bible. This was about 2000 AD, 2002 AD. And she says, well, why do you want a Bible? She says, well, there's a bunch of ladies who are going to have a Bible service or a Bible study service once a week, and I want to go, but I'm not supposed to have a Bible. So Evelyn said, well, you go buy a Bible, and you go to that study service, and you see how it helps you. And she did. And she was amazed at what her Bible now said as to what the priest had been telling her all her life. So that's not something that's gone by the wayside. It still exists. And I might add that that Bible, according to the people that I worked with, does not contain revelations. But anyway, this John Wycliffe, he translated the Bible into English, and it was a big hit. Infuriated the Pope, so he started looking for this guy. Well, he didn't find him until 44 years after he died. So just to show him, he had his bones dug up and they were crushed and thrown in a river. And that's the way they thought about punishment back then. This guy had been dead for 44 years. And then they reiterated that anyone caught reading an English Bible would be burned at the stake. In the 1490s, there was an Oxford professor. His name was Thomas Linacre. And he began studying the Greek translations. And he wrote, either the Greek scriptures are not gospel or we're not Christians. Because he was comparing the Greek manuscripts to the Vulgate. And that was beginning to become the way they looked at things back then if you weren't an obedient Roman Catholic. And as we know, in the mid-1400s AD, there was a guy named Johann Gutenberg. He invented the movable type printing press. No more handwritten, mass-produced books. And with the way it was back then, he printed a total of 180 Gutenberg Bibles. And there's 49 of them still remain. If you have one, they're worth some money. But this kind of technology revolutionized civilization. Books were not something for the privileged only anymore because they were being mass-produced now. Instead of taking 5 years to write a Bible, you could get it in 2 weeks or something like that. Therefore, knowledge proliferated. And so did Bibles. And so did people's idea of Bibles. The Gutenberg Bible was printed in 1455. The Erasmus Bible in 1516. The Luther Bible in 1534. The Tyndale Bible in 1526. The Cloverdale Bible in 1535. The Matthew Bible in 1537. The Great Bible in 1539. The Geneva Bible in 1560, the Bishop's Bible in 1568, and the Douay Rheims Bible in 1582. And each Bible had its own agenda. You see, at that point in history, there was no gap between politics and governments and religion and your way of life. So the Bibles that were produced were either pro or anti-royalty, or pro or anti-Protestant. King Henry VIII, who was a Catholic, he didn't have a change of conscience in publishing a Bible in English. What happened was that he requested that the Pope give him permission to divorce his wife and marry his mistress. The Pope refused. So King Henry reacted by divorcing his wife, marrying his mistress, renouncing Catholicism, taking England out from under the control of the Catholic Church. He was king. He could do it. Creating the Anglican, or the Church of England, and placing himself at its head. And that's how that church started. It was because he wanted to divorce his wife and marry his mistress. Quite a way to start a church, I'd say, from what we understand nowadays. He funded the printing of an English Bible just for spite. Just to show the Catholics that he could do it. After King Henry VII came King Edward VI, and then Queen Mary, who brought back Catholicism to England. And she burned Protestants at the stake by the hundreds. So here we go back again. But the information was still there. So when she died, King James VI of Scotland became King James I of England. And the clergy, the Protestant clergy at that time, approached King James, and they wanted a Bible that was scripturally accurate because it would become common knowledge with all the stuff in the margins and all of the additions and all this stuff that had been added to and taken out of Bibles over the years, or over the centuries, really. They wanted it to be scripture accurate, could be understood by the common man. Big deal. And not overtly proclaiming the Pope as the Antichrist. So he agreed. And this is how he did it. This is how the King James Version came into existence. Starting in 1604, he chose 54 scholars from the complete spectrum of religion. Puritans, the Dean of Westminster, Arab scholars, mathematicians, world travelers, famous book writers, I'm going to say, famous authors of the era, a lot of academic people. And says, I need a Bible. And he gave them the criteria. My guess is that they were sincere about it. They really thought this was something important. They got on their knees. And they asked for guidance. So they divided into six groups. These 54 guys did, 9 each. No tie votes. Each member of the groups on his own translated a section of the Bible. So not everybody translated the entire Bible. Their source material was a codex and the 9 most recent Bible editions. Each individual brought that translation to a meeting of a subcommittee where different versions brought by each translator was compared and one was settled on. Their basic principle was that everything had to agree in principle with everything else and had to agree with the original manuscripts. That was their basic premise for this, whether it passed or failed. That's why you had the Apocrypha, because those are the books that failed. What was agreed on by the subcommittees was then submitted to the General Revising Committee for the whole Bible. The revising scholars had the suggestion versions read aloud, no visible text, while holding on their laps copies of previous translations in English and Greek and Latin. The ear and the mind were the only editorial tools. They wanted the Bible to sound right. Now we have a word for that today, and the way I look at that anyway, as seeing now and reading what the product is, I have a word for that. They relied on the Holy Ghost. Did the Holy Ghost say this sounds right? This doesn't sound right. This needs change. This needs taken out. I believe so. That's what the Holy Ghost does today. If it didn't, they usually had a spirited discussion. And then when they had their product ready, they sent it to a final revising committee, which was 2 bishops and then the Archbishop of Canterbury and then the king. And that's how they compiled the Bible. It took them 5 years. It's called the 1611 Bible. As is with everything else, it wasn't an instant success because the most popular Bible at that time was the Geneva Bible. So King James did the only thing that a Christian would do back in that time. He had all the other Bibles burned and he chained the King James Version to all the pulpits and all the churches in England. Nothing like being subtle, huh? But it has become so entrenched in our language. It's become so used. You go look at an atlas of this country as the settlers came across this country and look at all of the biblical names that are towns. Every state is just full of biblical towns, biblical named towns. And it also has become entrenched in our language, which means they read it a lot. Ezekiel 4:10 comes a phrase from time to time. Isaiah 38:1, set thine house in order. Job 19:20, by the skin of my teeth. Joshua 23:13, know for a certainty. Genesis 4:16, east of Eden. Deuteronomy 32:10, the apple of his eye. Job 15:7, was made before the hills, old as the hills. And that's just a small cross-section of the everyday language that we use in this country today that's come out of the Bible. So it's had that much of an impact. Now, on the other hand, I can remember being at work and listening to guys at work to sell an argument, quote the Bible, and they were about 9 miles off because they didn't know a thing about it. But they still tried to use it as a point of reference to win an argument, even though they were dead wrong. Kind of like a joke I heard about there were 49ers back in the California Gold Rush. It was on Sunday and they were washing their clothes down by the creek, and they get to talking about church and stuff, and one of them says, well, I know the Lord's Prayer. The other one says, no, you don't. You don't know the Lord's Prayer. You don't know nothing about the Bible or religion. He says, I do too. He says, I know the Lord's Prayer. The other one says, I'll bet you an ounce of gold you don't know the Lord's Prayer. He says, okay. So they got their gold out and put it down. And the first guy starts, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And the other guy says, okay, here's your gold. I didn't know you knew it. So it goes from one end to the other of the spectrum. People that don't know anything about it use it. People that know a lot about it use it. People that just have a casual interest in it use these phrases out of it. And that's how much of an impact that book has had on us, whether they know it or not. And God did that. God did that with all of the stuff that went on, all of the things that have happened in the history of the world. God made sure that that information was preserved for us. And we can bemoan the fact, and I do, that there's so many different versions that take this out of it and that out of it, and you can go to a modern bookstore today and there's a half a dozen or more editions of Bibles with their own agenda. That's out there. But this one's still here. This one's here, which is a witness to it. Remember when I was talking about parchment? One of the things that destroys parchment is moisture. It's leather. It gets floppy, or it gets weak, I guess you say. It swells up. It loses the ability to hold the letters. So how did God send this information over here to this country, to this continent? How did he do that? Brass plates. And we still had it. So he knows what he's doing. He's always known what he's doing. He will always know what he's doing. We think we know what he's doing. But we get in the way. You get into Deuteronomy, you get into Leviticus, and you read it. Get rid of the ceremonial stuff. Get rid of that, what they call the Mosaic Law. That's all the ceremonial stuff. You look at the rest of it. I've got, in Numbers, for example, now the first chapter of Numbers, it lays out the first military draft. It Anybody know what span of control is when it comes to organizational business organizations? It's how many people you can manage. It's laid out in here. How many people that should be in a span of control? That was for Moses' sake when he had a couple of 3 million people. He was trying to decide incidents for every day. You know, in other words, he was being the judge. And it was wearing him out because it was constant. So God says, or caused him to be told, divide it up, spread out this authority. You take captains and give them 10 and sub-captains and give them 10, and he spread it all out to where he didn't have to do it all. Span of control. There's nothing that we do today that isn't in the Old Testament as an instruction. That's why he preserved it for our use, for our acceptance, for our benefit, for our common sense. I like the Bible. I like the Book of Mormon. They're the truth. I believe in them. I believe that there's no contradictions in the Bible or the Book of Mormon. If there's a contradiction that I find, I have made it because I haven't studied enough. For example, take Judas Iscariot's death. One gospel says that he went out and hanged himself. Another gospel says that he fell and his bowels burst open. Now, how do you reconcile that? Go back and look at history. When a man committed suicide back then, especially hanging, he was unclean. Nobody touched the body. And it stayed there until, now this is gross, but it stayed there until it rotted. And when the head came off, it fell and it busted open. And then they cleaned it up. So both accounts are true. That's why you've got 66 books in the Bible. That's why you have all of these books in the Book of Mormon. If you go through all, if you just take the passage, you may get it wrong. You got to take it all. You got to put it all in the proper perspective. It all carries weight because that's the way God had it designed. The laws of justice. The justice system in this country was based in the Bible, on the Old Testament. You can take a look all the way through there and you will find, let's see, Exodus. Exodus 21, this is one example. This is just one principle in our criminal justice system today. 21st chapter of Exodus, just for brevity's sake, I'm going to start with the 23rd verse. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give. And they're talking about hurting a woman with child. If any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. We all know that. What's used today? An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And the Israeli government, every time they get ready to start a war, they recite an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I have heard them do that on every war they've started since I've had a TV. That's boilerplate. That is not revenge. Let the subject or let the offense fit the punishment. You don't have a foot for a burning or a wound for an eye or a tooth for a stripe. A life for life, an eye for eye, a tooth for tooth, a hand for hand, a foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. That's why you don't have the same punishment for all crimes. Let the punishment fit the crime. And that's just one piece, what's in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, about just that one subject. Agriculture, animal husbandry, how to treat your family, how to treat a stranger, how to take the crops out of your field, what to leave in your field back then. It's all in there. It's called charity. It's common sense stuff that we do every day. We do it. We do it without even thinking. And most people don't have any idea that it's in the Bible. But it is. That's what taught us civilization. That's what taught us to be civilized. We can't be civilized without the scriptures. If you want to see what's being or what existence without the scriptures are, go look at tribes or civilizations that have never had the scriptures and see how they act. See what they do to each other. When James Adair, back in the 1700s, early 1700s, was an Indian trader down in the southeast, he found the five civilized tribes. They were different. They were different enough that he picked up on it. He wrote a book, Out of the Flames. He wrote it in 1740. There's 24 chapters in that book, and it's printed by the Cherokee Nation. 23, the first chapter is introductory. The next 23 chapters, he takes a passage out of the Old Testament, and he shows how those tribes followed it. And they didn't do it being a natural man. They had that information somewhere. They had received, of course, it's all oral history for them, but they had received those instructions and followed it. And if you want to hear some park rangers' theories about how they did that, like I have down in Georgia, go down and ask them. And then you'll know why the Book of Mormon plates ended up in New York. It wasn't magic. God caused it. That's the power of God. The Nez Perce in Idaho, when the Presbyterians went to proselyze the Nez Perce and they went to teach them the New Testament, they already knew it. We know why. The rest of the world doesn't, but we know how that happened. But we have to understand it, and that has to be a part of us for our appreciation of the information that is in these books, especially if we just go read them and then do what it says to do. I thank you for your time. And I didn't mess it up because I had notes.